Okay, so I was asked whether I would want to give a talk on this retreat, and if I'm honest, the answer was no. I didn't want to give a talk on this retreat. I wanted to have a retreat, just a beyond retreat. And I thought, well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? And then I looked down the list of possible talk titles, and I thought, aversion. Okay, maybe this is trying to tell me something. So I thought, okay, hatred, ill will, aversion, and metta. And that's what I'm going to talk about this evening. And I'm very fortunate that Paraga, wherever he is, gave the talk yesterday, because in a way, what I'm going to say could almost be just swapping the words around, so swapping hatred in for craving and swapping pain in for pleasurable sensations. You know, mutatis mutandis is a phrase that Subhuti likes using, making appropriate changes. In effect, similar things are true of both craving and hatred. So one way of looking at hatred is as frustrated craving. Yeah, so we have this desire for further pleasurable sensations, and that's checked for whatever reason. You know, the shops run out of almond croissants, or our partner rolls over in bed. It's that frustrated craving. Yeah. It's also there in the presence of suffering, in the presence of unpleasant vedana as well. It's a reaction to that unpleasant vedana. And as with craving, the reaction comes from a sense, well, this is the way Subhuti puts it, it comes from a sense that our selfhood, our being, is in some way diminished by the presence of pain, by the presence of suffering. I think what this is trying to say, perhaps, is that we believe that we're the kind of masters of our universe, and the existence of pain disproves that. You know, it shows that we aren't completely in control of what our lives are. It highlights that, and that in itself stimulates a reaction. And also, as with craving, it's typified by an exaggeration and an editing of our experience. So we exaggerate the painful over the pleasant, and we edit out the pleasant aspects of whatever the experience might be. I wanted to have a brief kind of philosophical interlude at this point and talk a bit about subject and object. Because there's something in the nature of hatred which is it's a kind of hardening of the polarization between subject and object. And what I mean by that is, so subject is the experiencer. It's what we think of as being on the inside of our experience. And object is whatever is out there. It's what's being experienced. And it doesn't necessarily have to be an object like a chair or a table. An object is anything that that we perceive. So that could be another person. It could be a macroscopic object. It could be an idea. It could even be a sensation of, just a sensation in the body could be an object. And so with hatred, there's the way I was kind of, if there was a mudra for hatred, it would be sort of that, you know, sort of keeping at bay, keeping at arm's length, repelling that which we believe to be the cause of our pain. On the one hand, and on the other hand, a kind of, you know, destruction, a desire to destroy whatever it is we believe causes our pain. And it's very much rooted in delusion, because it's not that what we think is the cause of our pain causes our pain. It's the fact that we're polarizing in such a sort of hard and fast way, which is at the heart of the experience of hatred. And in some ways, you can see the whole of the spiritual life as being a working out how to deal with and eventually overcome this subject-object polarization. You know, so ethics, meditation, wisdom is one of the schema that I used to describe the Dharma. And so you could see ethics as being a kind of attenuation of that polarization. So a kind of, through our actions, breaking down that hard and fast distinction between self and other. You know, like an act of generosity is a sort of outpouring or an extension of self into other, you could see. And then with meditation, you could see that as being the suspension. You know, where we learn in the course of meditation to suspend subject and object when we enter into dhyana, when we enter into absorption. And through wisdom, we transcend that. So we see that ultimately, subject and object, that polarization, that duality, arises in dependence upon conditions, then it's not ultimate. And as such, we're able to transcend it altogether. So sometimes I find that quite helpful as a way of kind of seeing how ethics, meditation, and wisdom is a progressive path, you know, attenuating, suspending, and eventually transcending this duality. Okay, philosophical interlude over. So what I plan to do this evening is to talk in relatively personal terms about each of the upper kleshas, the secondary afflictions which are associated with hatred. It's not going to be pleasant. It hasn't been pleasant preparing it. Anyway, and I think in some ways there's a teaching in that, even just thinking about these states of mind. So and I'll describe them in a minute. Even just dwelling on them. It's grim. It's sort of sticky. It's nasty to do that. So, providing one doesn't do it in the context of metta, which will be where I'll end up when I start talking more about goodwill and the Brahma Viharas. So the way I want to approach this evening is what I would suggest is a way to approach this in your discussion groups tomorrow. I'm not going to give you a list of questions. What I'm going to suggest is you look at your own personal experience of each of these upper kleshas in your groups. And also the Brahma Viharas as well. So the first upper klesha, the first secondary affliction that comes from hatred is krodha, or rage or anger. And this is very straightforwardly, the kind of explosive desire to destroy whatever it is that is causing us suffering, or whatever it is we believe is causing us suffering. And it's, I think it's summed up quite well by some English expressions, which those of you who aren't native English speakers, this will give you a bit of cultural background. So it's things like flipping your lid, flying off the handle, what's the other one? Losing your rag. You know, I'm not really sure what those literally mean. You know, but they communicate something about that. You know, I really lost my rag with that person, and it's just this sense of losing control, I suppose, losing control of oneself in one's desire to destroy what one believes to be causing one suffering.
How about taking the
mickey
out of it? Is that one of the expressions?
No. I'll come on to that. This isn't something that I have a lot of experience of, at least not in recent years. Probably the closest I got to it was on occasion, it was either a year or a couple of years ago, when I was a bit down in the dumps, a bit grumpy. And I was probably moaning to this person about the situation, whatever it was. I don't remember what it was. And this person had the temerity to offer me advice. just to sort of give me advice. This is what you need to do at this point. And, I lost it, and I very nearly struck them. There was a kind of split second within that of, kind of the mobilization of energy And then the person I was speaking to kind of clocked this was happening to me, and I saw that their expression was one of terror. And I realised, oh, I can't take this any further, and just dropped it and, I don't know, stormed off or something. So it's not something I experience a lot personally, but I realise that that's the seed of it is there. You know, if I'm enough in the corner or pushed into a corner, sometimes it might just take a word or two, or the offering, you know, the just a genuine offering of helpful advice to just tip me over the edge. And this is this is one of the things Subhuti said about Krodha, about rage, is how destructive it is to the spiritual community. And I don't think he elaborates on that so much in the book, but my sense of that is that one of the reasons why it's destructive is that it significantly curtails communication. If you know someone has a tendency to fly off the handle when they're confronted, it makes it very, very difficult for you to speak freely to them. It makes it very difficult for you to challenge them in any way. It makes communication, the kind of the basis of the spiritual community, impossible. And I have lived with people who have that tendency, and it just undercuts. It undercuts the communication because you feel like you're treading on eggshells all the time. That's another English expression. I think this is probably also what Shantideva's getting at when he, at the beginning of the chapter on the perfection of forbearance, he says something like this. Those to whom one honours with wealth and respect, and also one's dependents, even they long to destroy the master who is disfigured by hatred. Even friends shrink from him. In short, there is no sense in which one who is prone to anger is well off. And I think there's something about that. I particularly like that phrase, disfigured by hatred, because it really does just... there's something really ugly about it. Something ugly about that quality, particularly of anger and rage. Okay, so the next negative quality associated with hatred that I'm going to look at is resentment. And the translation for that is upanaha. And whereas with rage, there's a kind of instantaneous, and it's over in that moment, or at least the action is over in the moment. The with resentment, it's something which is kind of nursed. The grievance, whatever it is nursed over time. It's given credence again and again. There's some ways of spotting resentment. I definitely think there are ways of spotting resentment. So first of all, there is this kind of underlying private sense of ill will towards someone for something they've done to you, or you perceive them to have done to you. And one thing which is characteristic of this, at least in my experience, is whenever the trigger happens, whenever there's a trigger, whether it's that person or something they say, there's a sort of predictability in the trains of thought which are then entailed, the trains of thought which then follow. It's almost like a script just starts running at that point, a negative script about how they've done us down and about them, you know, how bad they are. I have to say, not to my credit at all, that this is probably one of the more familiar of the upaklesas to me, resentment. And one of the occasions on which it often arises is in relation to criticism. And one way or another, I seem to find myself in the way of criticism quite a bit. You know, so there's one particular person who sends me emails, and they number the points on the emails with criticisms. You know, so I actually received one of these shortly before I came here, and it was a 5-pointer. So sometimes there have been 9-pointers, you know. It's like, I've got to be careful actually in saying this, that I'm not just triggering the stories around this, but you know, so often my response to that will be, can't they see I'm doing the best that I can? You know, a sense of feeling undervalued, underappreciated. And by implication, the fact, that's interesting, isn't it? The belief that they aren't appreciating me. They aren't seeing all the good things that I'm doing. And instead, they're focusing in on, as it were, the sort of petty inconsistencies in the way I act or the things I say or whatever. And it can really niggle away. There's something about resentment, which is a real energy drainer, because you have to keep stoking it, you have to keep buying into the narrative, the resentful narrative. And as well, it's really boring. Actually, you find, as I say, that the trigger happens, and then the same story crops up. The story of ill will crops up again. One other thing in relation to resentment that, I'd invite you to think about, it's a bit of a kind of heady thing, it's not so personal, is quite how much ideologies seem to be based upon resentful narratives. So, you know, basically the idea that X is to blame for the world's ills, you know, whether that's the gutter press. That's an interesting expression as well, isn't it? The gutter press is one of my favourite resentful narratives. Or, you know, the Christian right in America, or the patriarchy, or, you know, there's kind of lots of ways in which, you know, the bourgeoisie, lots of ways in which ideologies are based upon the notion at base that a group of people of which I'm not a member is to blame for all of the world's ills. The reason why I bring that up is because I think it's really damaging to a Dharma practitioner to indulge in those kind of ideologies. The reason being principally because any view which suggests that I'm not responsible basically knocks the wind out of the sails of a Dharma life. You know, if it's because of the patriarchy that I'm experiencing this suffering at the moment, or because of the Eurosceptics or whatever that I'm experiencing this suffering at the moment, then I don't have to deal with it. It's their problem, and that is harmful to the leading of a Dharma life, I believe. The next one is spite. Next upaklesha is spite, which is pradasha in Sanskrit. And whereas the previous two upaklesha's both take something as their object, so whether it's another person or an idea or a group of people or whatever, with pradasha it's more like, the way Subhuti puts it, it's more of a general disposition. So it's a kind of underlying, I think the way he puts it is kind of spikiness, such that when something a little bit uncomfortable or painful comes up, you then chuck in a cynical word or a barbed comment, or it's sort of it's that background sense which then gives rise to a reaction. What does spite mean? I don't know exactly the dictionary definition, but I'll explain what I experience it to be, at least in this context. So one of the occasions of this for me is often if I'm doing a lot of computer-based work, and there's something about the environment of working on a computer which encourages in me a desire for urgency and immediacy. And it also sort of narrows my sphere of awareness down to whatever the size of screen it is I'm working on. You know, so whether it's a phone or a laptop screen or whatever. And I think what that can do is when my consciousness, as it were, is contracted in that way, small niggles appear much bigger. You know, I do become kind of spiky in relation to slight things. Like, you know, the printer doesn't work for whatever reason. Oh, for goodness sake, you know, won't the printer work? Or Firefox crashes, or whatever it might be. Small things can appear amplified because my consciousness feels smaller. I think it can also be it can also give rise to the kind of sarcastic things like, you know, sort of, oh, well done. You know, someone does something and you're not very happy. Oh, well done. You know, it's just sort of thorny and it's sort of not able to absorb. It's not big enough to absorb whatever it is that may be a little bit uncomfortable. Then there's envy. Or irshia, I think that's how it's pronounced, irshia. It's funny how you don't often hear these words used in Buddhist contexts because they're difficult to pronounce. all the nice ones are taken, like, you know, metta, yeah. Okay. But irshia. Yeah, so it means envy. And I've got a confession to make, which is relatively hot off the press. In relation to envy. One thing I like to do when I'm giving a talk is always have some element of risk involved. This is the element of risk. Okay, so it's in relation to Paragus's talk yesterday, which I thought was absolutely excellent. You know, I thought... So I will just rejoice before I go on to the envy bit. It was very clear and comprehensive, you know, in its sort of detailed appraisal of the material, because there's a lot in Subhuti, and I think you covered it very well. It was also very personal. I think we could all relate to what you were saying. Very engaging as well. Yeah, I could say more. Anyway, I was sitting there over there. Where James is now, sitting there, and it was as if every time you got a laugh from the audience, my sense of self just shrunk a little bit. I was thinking, oh, I've got to do this tomorrow. the reason why I realised that it was envy was that what then started up was a story to the effect of looking to put down Paraga and his talk. You know, so it was. I won't go into too much detail, but it's things like, oh, well, he over-egged that point a bit, or I'd have put it differently, or you know, so the time's going on, you know, and as in doing that, it was a sort of desire to want to make myself feel better, in the face of, you know, what was, I thought, an excellent talk, that made a claim on me. I felt threatened by that, and the narrative of. Trying to put the other person down was a way of somehow redressing that balance. Yeah, so the risk was, in saying that, that I realised Subhuti in the book says it's very difficult to confess that sort of thing. And I thought, how's this going to go down? How's this going to go down with the people here, me saying how envious I was of that? Anyway, let's we'll see. So that's a particularly nasty one in the sense that it really cuts you off from the good in the world. Actually, you know, when there is good taking place, somehow the desires of the ego to reinflate overshadow them. It's really unpleasant like that. Okay, and the final one of these related to hatred is malice or vihingsa. So hingsa means kind of harm or causing harm, and vihingsa is an intensifier. The v bit means kind of cruelty, malice, a desire to it's almost a kind of a pleasure in the suffering of another. Vile, really, isn't it? Really, really nasty thing. So not a lot comes to mind, and for this in relation to me. And I think quite possibly some of that is that I'm just not looking hard enough. That there's something about me that just doesn't want to go into that area. I don't know what that is. It was interesting reflecting on hatred more generally. How before I became a Buddhist, I didn't think I hated anything. You know, there's this idea that I'm a good guy, I'm a nice guy, I don't hate anything. And I think possibly there's still some of that knocking around in relation to malice and cruelty. I think probably where it does come in for me would be in humour, particularly the schadenfreude type humour. Laughing or teasing someone because something's gone badly for them. I think that's probably for me where it comes most strongly in. Just taking the teasing a little bit too far and actually causing pain or perhaps deliberately causing pain through doing that. I think it can also come in where one gets one's entertainment, or where one thinks that where one looks to for entertainment. I mean, there's some really gruesome stuff on the internet. And on films and TV, which is effectively kind of faking people's suffering, and we call that entertainment. Just like, you know, I sort of think to myself, isn't there enough suffering going on really in the world that we don't need to fake more of it and then put it on the TV? Anyway. So I think one question maybe to ask oneself in relation to malice is, well, actually, does that form part of my menu of entertainment when I'm sitting down to watch something? Do I choose to watch something that I know is going to involve people being tortured or shot or killed or whatever? Yeah. Right, may I be purified of all that? let's move on to something else. The opposite of hatred is advesa. Non-hatred, and this is the word which is it comes up in, I think it's Dhammapada verse 5, where the Buddha says, "Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified in the world; by love are they pacified." This is an eternal law. And the word which Bhante translates as love is advesa, literally non-harm. So it's got a wider meaning than love, I think, and I think it. It has a spectrum going from even just the slight tendency to want to engage with another being on their own terms, as opposed to engaging on them in relation to them causing me pain. So it's just kind of tipping the balance. It goes from just tipping the balance through to the perfection of Karana, the perfection of the Brahma Viharas. I think the way Subhuti puts it is something like a happy weakening of a sense of separation between self and other. So it comes out of recognising actually that hatred is a form of tension, it's a form of pain in itself, and a desire to let go of that pain, let go of the pain that we're causing ourselves through indulging in hatred. And Subhuti very helpfully talks about a kind of it's a kind of spectrum of this advesa. I think I'd add in there before he starts that this desire to turn towards the being of another on their own terms. Yeah, because then he goes into say he describes the first rung on the ladder. As was simply not wishing to cause others harm, or even a kind of revulsion to the idea of causing harm. And I think this is a real sea change for me in the course of the last 5 or 6 years since I've been more seriously practicing, is that I do notice that there's almost a kind of quasi-aesthetic revulsion to the causing of pain in others. Seeing someone pick up a newspaper to hit a fly, in a sense it's a small thing, but it's like, actually, do you really need to do that? There's a revulsion to the idea of causing pain. And often, actually, when people ask me why I'm vegetarian, increasingly my answer is, well, I just can't do it. I can't eat meat. I can't participate in something like that, which is so clearly causing suffering to others. It's almost like I don't necessarily have a kind of reasoned excuse anymore for being vegetarian. It's more like, I just don't want to go down there anymore. So after that, then Subhuti talks about starting to wish others well to the extent that it doesn't inconvenience us too much. That's the next rung on the ladder. And I guess this sort of tallies with the good friend stage in the Metta Bhavana, in the sense that wishing our good friend well is sort of natural, isn't it? Yeah, it's natural to want to do that. It's not putting us out in any way to want someone who we like and who likes us to be well. And then the next rung would be starting to see a bit more of the objective situation. So starting to see that one's own preferences and one's senses of security, or the sources of security, as it were, are part of a much bigger picture, and an ability, therefore, to set aside those preferences and that self-concern in the interest of others. And again, this is a spectrum as well, so spectrum within a spectrum. You know, it might be buying a cappuccino for a homeless guy on the way to the bus station. Actually, I've got loads of time. £1.50 is not very much. I'll do that. It doesn't kind of put me out. Through to even risking one's own life for the benefit of someone else. So there's quite a wide range in there of ways of putting oneself just to one side and just responding to what the objective needs of those people are in that moment. And then there's the last rung on the ladder is altogether transcending this duality, as I put it. At the beginning, there's duality between self and other. So there's no longer even anything that needs defending. One no longer needs to seek sources of security. One can just spontaneously respond. So clearly that's quite an elevated expression of goodwill. I'm just going to talk in just for the last bit a bit on the Brahma Viharas, so on metta, mudita, karuna, and upekkha. And what I'll say about metta is that, well, we're wishing the other people in metta the highest happiness. I mean, the way it's put in the Karaniya Metta Sutta is, may all beings be happy and secure. May all beings be happy in their heart of hearts. You know, it's really, and actually what that means is that we wish them awakening. We wish them enlightenment. Because that is the highest happiness. That is the best happiness we can get. Now, it might be difficult to, you know, enlightenment for you might be something which is, it seems too abstract to wish someone that. But I think as an experiment or as a practice, you might try connecting with your highest happiness in your life and actually engaging with people on the basis that they might experience that highest happiness too. I guess for a Buddha, what that must be like is seeing inherently within each individual the potential for awakening and responding to them on that basis. For us, it might not be that much. It might not be that high, but it will be connecting with wanting the best for them, wanting the very, very best for them. And with metta, there's a very natural. For a long time, I hadn't really clocked why metta bhavana was a samatha practice. You know, how one could get into absorption through metta. But I think with the metta bhavana, what one's doing is practicing softening and expanding. So softening those barriers between self and other, and expanding kindness into that space. And that's so going back to the philosophical interlude earlier, that acts directly on that hard and fast polarization. Yeah, there's something very natural in the softening and expanding of metta, which leads into the way I put it was this suspension of subject and object. So kind of seeing metta bhavana in that way, I found very helpful in getting more deeply into that quality. So it's seeing, I'm weakening or softening that whatever it is that's separating me from others. Yeah, something opens up there. And then metta meets suffering, metta meets joy, and they become the sort of the two, if you like, middle Brahma Viharas. I'm very lucky in the line of work that I'm in, coordinating young Buddhist events, activities, that I spend quite a lot of my life rejoicing in people, believe it or not. I really enjoy doing that. It's just such a great part of my my job. And the way I sometimes think about it is that it's like free pleasure. Mudita, rejoicing in others' merits is free pleasure. In a sense, you don't have to do anything. They've done it all. They've done the skillful thing. All you have to do is just name it. You know, name it truthfully. And I find that spills a lot into my interactions now. In particular, there's a time a while back where I was at the... I was spending some time with the parents of some university friends of mine. And I was just sitting around the dining room table with their dad, who's a very big kind of former rugby-playing Welshman. And I was just reflecting with him on what a good dad I thought he was. Because, these are my friends, I know them very well. And I could see in them how much care, self-sacrifice, love went into their upbringing from this man, from Jim. And it was beautiful, yeah. So he starts welling up, and then I start welling up. And we're both just sort of we're basking in the skillful karma that he'd engaged in for, 20-odd years in supporting in a very sort of unconditional way his children. It's one of those things, mudita and rejoicing in merits, which I just don't think you can get enough of. And I think particularly in that example, I'm not sure anyone had spoken to him like that before. The way he responded to it was just so full of gratitude for it. It's a rare quality, and it's something we really have to give. I'm realising time is pressing on, so I'll be a bit more do a bit more of a summary with the other two. So with Karuna, it's metta meeting the suffering in another, and it's in particular being able to hold that suffering without. Without feeling a need to go in and sort it all out. It may be that action can be taken, but very often the action that we want to take is based on ego reasons. It's based on the fact that we somehow feel diminished or defensive because another is suffering and we can't do anything about it. So sometimes karuna is just about learning to sit with the suffering of another, sit in solidarity with them. And then there's upekka or upeksha, which is equanimity. And in a way, this quality is the culmination of all the other Brahma Viharas, the culmination of metta, mudita, karuna. And sometimes it's seen as emerging from an understanding of the impersonal nature of the law of karma. And what I mean by that is the fact that insofar as beings are skillful or unskillful, to that extent they experience joy and suffering. And I think the reason why it's equanimous or it's a state of calm is in recognising that, that doesn't make a claim on us. It's their actions which are giving rise to those mental states. It's not our responsibility to fix that, or there's a limitation to where our responsibility can go, the sphere of that responsibility. And I think there's also a dharmic level to that as well. So where it comes in on a dharmic level is something in the nature of the understanding of the bodhisattva. So the bodhisattva recognizing that, or recognizing the pain in dukkha and the pleasure in positive mental states, and at the same time recognizing that they're empty. You know, they've arisen in dependence upon conditions, and it's sort of holding that together, holding those two things together, both the fact that pain is pain, and not to diminish the significance of that pain, but also to see, it's arisen in dependence upon conditions, it's shunyata. And yeah, and that very much culminates in the bodhisattva's attitude of, the way it's put in the Diamond Sutra is making this kind of absolute vow to liberate all beings from suffering, because there are no beings to liberate. So it's a deep, deep understanding of the way things are, manifesting in action which is no longer based on ego, manifesting in this sort of purely spontaneous desire. The way it's sometimes described is this sort of play of the bodhisattva, and I think that the play emerges out of the fact that they realise there's nothing to lose, that ultimately pleasure, pain and so on are empty, there's nothing to lose, so let's just bring forth these qualities of metta, karuna, mudita, etc. And that gives the tranquility of equanimity within it. Okay, so I'll just briefly sum up now. What I'd invite you to do in your groups tomorrow is to approach each of these, or in fact overnight, is to reflect on each of these qualities. So hatred is the klesha, then rage, anger, resentment, spite, envy, and then the Brahma Viharas, metta, mudita, karuna, upekka. And really make it personal. I'd encourage you to rootle around and see if you can find examples in your life where you see these unskillful mental states arising, and in a sense see your group as a way of just putting it out there, avoiding the slyness concealment that Parago was mentioning yesterday. Okay, thank you very much.